Yeah, so this is my show. I like having a radio show, man. It's pretty alright. Yeah. Hang on, I gotta write an email real quick to my buddy here. Alright, so I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. It's a goddamn Scott Horton show. I named it that because that's my name. Well, it was called Anti-War Radio for a long, long time, which it still is pretty much, you know, subject-wise, but I thought maybe I could get more people to recognize the show, maybe pay me some money or something if I named it after me, you know, because I need money. Because the Democrats, they doubled the cost of my premiums, and they've, pretty much doubled the cost of my deductible, too. Which means that I have a de facto catastrophic only junk policy that I can't afford anyway because of the damned Democrats. So I have to name the show after myself so I can try to, like, you know, be businessy or entrepreneurial or whatever. For an ideological capitalist, I'm terrible at marketing. But anyway, I thought, well, you know, maybe I make some more money so I can afford health insurance. Since the Democrats got to raise my prices all the time. Their stupid democracy that I hate. All right, anyway. So, it's the Scott Horton Show. That's the short story long about how it got that name. I'm sorry. Here, let me drink some coffee for a second. Oh, no, that's too hot. I can't drink that. All right. Well, I'll drink it in a minute. I'm not going to make much sense before then. I will tell you this. I was able to go to the National Summit to reassess the American-Israel special relationship over the weekend. Well, not over the weekend. On Friday. And it was great. It was put on by Phil Giraldi's group, the Council for the National Interest, and Grant Smith's group, the Institute for Research Middle East Policy, and a couple of others. And it was pretty good. It was pretty dang good. And I got to give the, hey, good morning, everybody, welcome to the show, keep your questions short thing, and I got to moderate one of the panels. And anyway, a lot of great speeches were given, and I got to meet a lot of guests of this show that, you know, I've talked to before but never met in person before, so that was really cool. And I got to meet a lot of fans of the show who came up and said nice things to me about how they like listening to the show, so that was really great, too. Hi, everybody, thank you very much for all the kind things you said. And then I got to see some old friends, too, like Karen Kotowski and Ray McGovern and a few others, Gareth Porter, people that I've met before. But, you know, hey, it's great to see again kind of thing. So it was a really cool thing for me, you know. I mean, really, there were like, you know, 10 people that I've talked to before but never met in person that I was able to meet in person. So that was really the highlight of the thing personally. But professionally speaking, I like to believe, and there's going to be more and more media coverage of this thing as we go forward, I believe. I like to believe that this conference really helped move the ball forward as far as legitimizing dissent about American policy toward Israel. Now, there's no reason in the world that it should have ever been illegitimate, other than for a long time, the lobby, I guess, was able, and the media were able to successfully, you know, create this narrative that, well, just everybody knows, sort of really the lie by omission more than anything else. Just everybody knows we all favor Israel. They're the good guys, and they're surrounded by bad guys and poor little guys, and we got to help them and save them all the time, and their interests are the same as ours. And when will the Palestinian terrorist occupation of their West Bank ever end? And all that kind of crap that people believe. And I think that, you know, this is really helping move that ball forward, that it's perfectly okay for anybody to criticize Israel and to criticize America's relationship with Israel and to criticize Israel's lobby inside the United States and, you know, for its leverage and the way that it uses its leverage over American foreign policy. It's all fine. And you don't have to be a liberal Jewish Zionist either. You don't have to be able to say, oh, well, I'm part Jewish, or I'm Jewish, or I'm a liberal Zionist, or I'm some kind of something as your, you know, disclaimer That's why it's okay for me to criticize Israel. You could be anybody and still criticize Israel. And I think, really, does anybody believe anymore that, oh no, only an anti-Semite would criticize Israel? They just have some bigotry chip on their shoulder and focus on Israel as their excuse or whatever, like in the old narrative. Nobody buys that anymore. More and more people can see how detrimental American support for Israel is to American national security, and I mean in the genuine kind of sense. The way our support for their country puts our population in danger. And more, the accusation that somebody's an anti-Semite just for saying so falls flat. It's really not working anymore. As Stephen Walt put it in his speech, after he and John Mearsheimer wrote their piece on the Israel lobby back in 2005, I think it was. It could have been six. Early six. I think it was 05. When they first wrote their essay, The Israel Lobby, for the London Review of Books, which it was originally supposed to be published, I think, in The Nation. And then they backed out. So they took it to the London Review of Books, and then everyone called them Nazis and blah, blah, blah. But nobody really believed that, because everybody knew that's not true. Stephen Walt's a decent guy, man. Come on. John Mearsheimer, he's an alright guy. And they got a book deal. So that was really the beginning of the end of that false smear. I mean, and, you know, I'm more than happy to call any actual anti-Semite an anti-Semite, and I will be the first one to categorize that kind of thing as completely beyond the pale and outside the bounds of civilized discourse. But that doesn't have anything to do with just plain old criticism of Israel and the lobby, and I think that distinction is becoming more and more plain to people. And I think, you know, I went to the dinner with all the different speakers the night before the big event on Friday. And a lot of the statements around the room about who I am and why I'm here started out with, one day I was minding my own business and all of a sudden I found out something. Right? Like one lady, he had done a Save the Children. And she just happened to, you know, by luck of the draw, bad luck, good luck of the draw, happenstance, she got a young Shiite girl from a refugee camp in southern Lebanon. Now, she didn't know that there were a bunch of, victims of Israel living in southern Lebanon, being bombed, hiding out from the IDF all day and whatever, and trying to stay alive and eating garbage and whatever. But she found out the hard way from her new pen pal, from the Save the Children Fund and whatever. And anyway, and there are 100 stories like that. Everybody's just, one day I met this guy who told me this thing and I didn't believe it. So I read the book and I was like, holy crap, and I've been a pro-Palestinian activist ever since, or whatever, those kind of stories. And I think when this thing was on C-SPAN all day on Friday, I don't know if it was C-SPAN 2 or 3 or what, but still, I think thousands of people saw this, and I think there must have been thousands of stories of, you know, one day I saw this thing on C-SPAN where you had, you know, the FBI agent in charge of the Pollard case from the counterintelligence division. You had a retired general. You had a survivor of the attack on the USS Liberty. You had, former CIA officers talking about Israel's threats to American security. And you know, all these people talking about the history of the founding of Israel and all the dirty deeds done pretty cheap to get it all taken care of in democratic politics and all that stuff. That's certainly changing some minds. I don't know, in terms of stupid old football analogies, I don't know why. I guess it's apt, right? Because politics is just war on a subtler level, just like football, right? So, yeah. Moving the ball forward a little bit on the issue of, hey, everybody, let's all talk frankly and honestly about Israel issues. All right, good. And so it went well, and I think next year will be even better. And, you know, man, I got to meet Jim Loeb for a minute. He was kind of annoyed with me, I think. Oh, hi, Scott. Yes, nice to meet you. But you know how I am. Hi, Jim. Oh, yeah. So good to see you. Anyway, and I got to hang out with Gareth, man. That's all I care about. Gareth the Great. Gareth Porter the Heroic. So, Grant Smith is going to be on the show later on, talk about the great success. Marcy Wheeler's also coming up. We're going to talk CIA and NSA stuff. And Ted Snyder on the coup in Ukraine and backlash and all that. So, hang tight. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. see if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org.
That's correct.
Huh?
Yep.
All right. All right, welcome back to the show. Marcy Wheeler coming up, so don't you go nowhere. You gotta listen to me babble for a sec here. Yeah, man, I want to say one more thing, housekeeping-wise type thing about, you know, stuff that's not that substantive, and that is, go to my website, scotthorton.org, if you want to see me give a speech, not this, Nat Summit thing, I was just sort of moderating there, but, on February the 15th, you might have heard me talk about it, might have heard the ads for it, on February the 15th, I gave a speech for the Future Freedom Foundation, at the International Students for Liberty Conference. First John Glazer, and then myself, and the presentation was Libertarianism versus the Empire. You can find the video at my website, but I've gotten a lot of really nice compliments from it in the email and that kind of thing, so I was thinking, well, I don't know, hell. It starts off kind of rocky. All of my speeches start off kind of rocky, and then, you know, it gets a little better. Sort of like the show every day. Yeah. But some people really liked it, so if you want to check it out, that's at scotthorton.org, or it's at youtube.com/scotthortonshow if you want to look at it there. And it's also at the Future Freedom Foundation's YouTube channel as well, if you want to look at that. So John Glazer and Scott Horton, Libertarianism versus the Empire. He talks about the libertarianism part, I talk about the Empire part, but anyway. We were kind of out of order because my plane was delayed. I actually showed up one moment before going on. I got there and they were like, you going on? Get up there, Horton. All right. I got up there and did the dang thing. So, I blame the airlines for any flaws in the speech there. Okay, good. Or the weather. All right. But I refuse to take responsibility for any of my own errors. You got that? Okay. All right. Now, next thing I want to say is this 777 that's missing. Now, I don't want to be all paranoiac or whatever, but I think it could be that this is a terrorism type of a thing. It reminds me, it's like this ridiculous person they keep bringing on CNN today, who's talking about the Bojinka plot, Ramzi Youssef, the guy that bombed the World Trade Center the first time. His plot to, well, he had a bunch of different plots, to kill the Pope, to kill Bill Clinton, to hijack a bunch of planes and crash them 9/11 style, and also to blow a bunch of planes up over the Pacific all at the same time, or right around the same time, and that was called the Bojinka plot. And he did a test run, Ramzi Youssef did a test run on a Philippine Airlines plane with a Casio watch and a bomb under his seat that killed a Japanese businessman but failed to detonate the fuel tank and destroy the plane. This was actually brought up by Ramzi Youssef's, or I think they tried at least to bring this up at his trial, his defense tried to bring it up at his trial when Flight 800 blew up, that, see, it couldn't have been Ramzi Youssef that's the plane bomber. Oh, you know what it is? I'm overstating that. There was some suspicion. Peter Lance, for example, was suspicious. I'm not sure if it went farther than this. It may have gone farther than this. I'm not denying it went farther than this, but this is what I know of it, that that Peter Lance suspected that perhaps it was one of Ramzi Youssef's acquaintances or, associates who bombed Flight 800 the same way, blowing up the center fuel tank, in order to cast doubt on Youssef's guilt when he was in the middle of his trial. because he was in the middle of his trial in New York, and they were accusing him not just of the World Trade Center bombing, but of all the conspiracy in the Bojinka plot and all that, too. Now, I tend to go with the somebody shot a missile at it, whether it was a Navy ship or a shoulder-fired missile from the end of the beach there or what, I'm not certain, but it seems, you know, probable that that was a missile strike rather than a bomb on the inside of the plane. But anyway, I'm on a tangent anyway. Ramzi Youssef did attempt to blow up one airplane. And what's hilarious to me, this is another tangent, but I can't help but say it. All morning on CNN, they've been referring to this time that Ramzi Youssef killed a Japanese businessman on a Philippine Airlines flight with his bomb that failed to detonate the center fuel tank and destroy the entire plane, and yet did kill somebody. She kept calling it, this expert guest on there, she kept calling it a dry run. Yeah, it's a dry run. Well, they might be using passports if it was a dry run. This plane that's now been missing for 3 days, that apparently, you know, they didn't even say Mayday. They just vanished. Must have been some kind of catastrophic something, they're assuming. And mixed with stolen passports as part of this story. So then, based on the speculation that there was some kind of explosion, that this was some kind of attack, they're saying dry run. Well, how the hell is a successful attack a dry run? A dry run would be going on there without explosives, but just seeing if you can get your Casio watch on board. Seeing if you can get the seat that you want. See whether anyone's going to be suspicious if you bring your three friends with you. See how easy it is to change planes in Bangkok or something. That would be a dry run, you stupid idiots. On CNN all day. Dry run. Yeah. If in fact someone smuggled a bomb onto this plane and blew it up and killed everyone over the ocean, that would have been a dry run. What's dry about it? There's blood everywhere. They're soaking their corpses at the bottom of the sea now. Dry run. Now, trial run. Ramzi Youssef killed a Japanese businessman when he set off a bomb on a Philippine Airlines flight on a trial run for his Bojinka plot, which was to attempt to blow up 11 airliners at once over the Pacific. Oh, I see. A trial run for a larger plot of doing the very same thing. Nothing dry about that time that Ramzi Youssef killed some Japanese businessman who presumably had like a wife and children who miss him dearly. That wasn't a dry run at all, was it? Trial run? Okay. And I'm sorry, but I sat there and watched these idiots on CNN all day long talking about, on the presumption that this was some kind of successful terrorist attack that killed 230 people, that you could call that a dry run. Who are these people? Why are they the ones in charge of telling us what the hell is going on in the world when they don't have any idea what in the hell they're talking about at all? You know, I heard that the reason planes fly high is because they fly fast. Is that true, Mr. Expert? What makes a plane fly anyway? Well, joining us now is our expert from the Justice Department, who thinks that maybe this possible successful terrorist attack could have been a dry run. And then our next guest will be Bob Baer, the former CIA officer, and we'll ask him whether he thinks this was a dry run or not. Who is writing the teleprompter script for this crap? Somebody stop for a minute, take a bite of your sandwich, drink a bit of Diet Coke, and ask yourself, wait, what's dry about a successful attack? Wouldn't a dry run just be a test to see if you can get the van where you want to park it? Or something like that. See if you can smuggle a starter pistol past security? That would be a dry run. Pardon me while I go blow my brains out. I've been watching CNN all day. I'm about to puke blood. I'm about to puke up my ulcer. Anyway, I think maybe this is a terrorist attack, man. I don't know. I also think this. Here's my second theory, and I don't really favor one over the other. My second theory is that the Boeing 777 can't be trusted. Because I read this article by Andrew Coburn in Harper's Magazine. I can't remember whether I interviewed him about this one or not. I try to always interview Andrew Coburn about all of his great journalism because he's great. But he, I certainly read this. If I didn't interview him about it, I apologize to you because I should have. But he wrote this thing. You know the deal. We all know the scam. They build a fighter jet in 100 million different pieces all over the country, in every congressional district they possibly can, so that no congressman can come out against any military project because jobs in his district, right? Each out of 435 House districts, each and every one of them makes one part of one gadget for the stupid piece of crap F-35 or something like that. That's the model for the military-industrial complex, and that's the model for Boeing. Boeing has their facilities, their design, their engineering, their decision-making, their command control, their fabrication and manufacturing and everything else is completely spread out all over the freaking place for political reasons, because that's the incentive structure when your company is a big, fat, stinking welfare parasite like Boeing, sucking off of hard-working, honest people. And so what happens is when they build civilian airliners like the 777, they build them on that same model. That's the shape of their company for political reasons. And so they end up making really bad decisions like, let's use these batteries that are these super volatile chemical mixtures in there and sometimes burst into really hot flame, like when you burn magnesium hot or whatever kind of fires. Let's use plastic and carbon fiber at the juncture where the wing meets the fuselage because, you know, in our computer model, we like it and whatever. And what in essence, what it amounts to is they're taking major risks with a really big plane. And it's funny because I'm actually confused about this. I'll be honest with you. I keep seeing on CNN, they say, oh, 777s have been around forever, and they've got a million miles, and they're one of the safest planes in the sky. But I thought they just came out with those a few years ago. Is it a 787 or something? What did I read to Andrew Coburn about? So there's a discrepancy there. Maybe someone in the chat room can set me straight about, you know, maybe I just need to Google Andrew Coburn myself this second and see what the hell I'm talking about. Because I could have swore. Isn't it the 777 where the door came off? The door blew off on the one of the original test runs. All right, I'm googling. Boeing's plastic planes. Come on, go faster! Oh, it's the 787 is the one that his plane is about. That was my confusion. Well, still. I don't know. Maybe not still. This song is right about me. I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all the stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state. Available at scotthorton.org/Amazon. Oh, man. You know, there was one more thing about CNN that I gotta say. They're plugging Sanjay Gupta's gonna double down on his support for legalizing medical marijuana on CNN, which is valiant of him. Even if, you know, pretty late in the game. But anyway, it's good to see him coming forward like that. But part of the coverage they were doing promoting that today, they interviewed this family who their young son, who I don't know, was maybe 4 or 5 years old or something, who had, maybe, no, younger than that, 3 or 4 or something, has terrible epilepsy with, you know, I don't know, dozens and dozens and dozens of major seizures every week. But medical pot helps him. And then the question, and it was an honest question by the CNN people, was, you know, just how do we balance this helpless young boy's need for medical pot against the right of the majority of people who are concerned that maybe someone else might enjoy themselves if they smoke this stuff and something like that. And I was just thinking that the obvious answer is that if all those people with those concerns just shoot themselves in the head and die, then the rest of us can just live our lives and be happy and not have to be concerned about their concerns. How could anyone be so concerned that their right to oppress a helpless little boy overwhelms somehow his right, when you have no right like that at all in the first place, and that somehow could outweigh, could be balanced somehow against the right of a helpless little boy to take the medicine that saves him from his medical condition. This is, it's like listening to complete psychopaths talk, only it's not even that they're psychos, it's just that they're so dim-witted, they can't even hear their own words. What about the rights of the concerned mothers of everybody else's kid to stop this kid from taking medicine? How about screw them? They don't have the right. They never had the right to oppress this little kid at all. End of argument. Everyone who was ever on the other side of that argument all along has always been wrong. And it's as simple as that. How about that? People are crazy, man. Anyway, sorry. Our first guest today on the show is our good friend Marcy Wheeler from the great blog EmptyWheel.net, and she's also at First Look Media, The Intercept there. Welcome back to the show. Marcy, how are you doing?
Hey, good to be back.
Sorry to keep you on hold during that, but man, I felt like saying it. Anyway, there's so much news to cover on your beat. We better get to it and quick. First of all, can you give us the basic synopsis of this McClatchy story coming out in pieces here now about the Dianne Feinstein Senate Intelligence Committee and their attempted oversight of the CIA on this on their torture program, and the committee staff and the CIA both breaking the law, spying on each other? What is going on here?
Emphasis on attempted oversight. So in December of 2012, the committee voted out by narrow margins the report. John McCain voted with the Democrats to release the report. And the CIA was supposed to give their response within 3 months. They took 6 months. They said, oh, my gosh, you've made all these mistakes. And either subsequent to that or before that, the committee staffers who had been working in a facility provided by the CIA, they weren't allowed to work in their own offices, had learned that everything the CIA said in its response to the report was refuted by an internal report. They're calling it the Panetta Report. The CIA claims it's not a really report. It's just a synopsis of what the CIA itself said. But one way or another, people within the CIA in 2009 had said precisely the same thing that the Senate Intelligence Committee had said, which is that CIA was lying, the torture program wasn't effective. In other words, when the CIA last year came back to the Intelligence Committee and said, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong, the Intelligence Committee tried to say, but you guys agree with us. In 2009, you guys agreed with us. So now, here's where the accusations start. As I said, the CIA provided this facility, and they and a contractor, I think it was SAIC, spent a bunch of time and money vetting everything that the committee staffers could touch. They're now claiming that somehow the committee staffers got outside of the documents they were allowed to touch. I'm not sure if that's true. One way or another, in December, some of the senators started saying, hey, what about this this Panetta report from 2009, which shows that you guys actually agree with us? And after that, the CIA came back to the committee and said, you guys access documents you're not supposed to access. And the committee did the math and said, wait a second, you guys are spying on us.
Mm-hmm.
So the committee claim is that the CIA is spying on their overseers, which appears to be true. They had access to, they basically audited the access logs for the network. That's the best.
Now, wait a minute, I'm a little confused. Help straighten me out here. The CIA, they basically, they accidentally kind of tipped their hand by saying, hey, you guys have some documents that you're not supposed to have, or it was the Senate staff that tipped their hand and kind of revealed that they knew things from documents that the CIA knew they weren't supposed to have, or does it matter?
In a hearing, a couple of the senators said to, I think it was John Brennan, said, hey, how come this report from 2009 says what we believe and not what you guys said in your report trying to prevent us from publishing this document.
Oh, right. And then they said, hey, and wait a minute, you weren't supposed to have had that report at all? That's the CIA's position, that the committee had no right to the Panetta report?
Right, and they're saying things like it postdated the end date of the study, which was supposed to be 2006, even though torture continued after that. Mm-hmm. They're saying that... you know, I don't know what they're claiming as to how the Intelligence Committee accessed it, because these documents were so heavily vetted, to great expense to you and me, I might add, and as a delaying tactic, that it's sort of remarkable that they're even claiming that the Intelligence Committee got the documents, but they are. And so everything's been referred to DOJ, to FBI, to investigate.
Oh, well, then Eric Holder's going to take good care of it, right?
Well, I made the point that this is very reminiscent. A bunch of years ago, several years ago, the people defending the actually dangerous detainees at Gitmo, the ones who'd been tortured, had done what's called the John Adams Project, and they had gone via their own means and found the identity of the people who had tortured their clients. And that's legitimate. I mean, in a death penalty trial, you're allowed to say, hey, these people were tortured, or even to say this evidence came via X, Y, and Z torture administered by Deuce Martinez. Mm-hmm. Deuce Martinez wasn't a torturer. He was an interrogator, but he was present at the time. And a very similar to move to what they're doing now, they squawked and DOJ said, we don't think this needs to be investigated. They went to John Brennan, who was then in the White House, and said, it has to be investigated. Oh, my gosh, the identities of our torturers is sacrosanct. That, you know, especially the people who were tortured aren't allowed to know the identities of the people who tortured them. Patrick Fitzgerald did an investigation, and now John Kiriakou is sitting in jail. For, by the way, sharing identities that never got published. I mean, sharing identities, the most dangerous thing he is in jail for is sharing the identity of one of the torturers that only got published in a classified, a top secret court filing done by lawyers who have top secret clearance that was never made public. So you and I don't know this torturer's name. It's not public. But it was allowed to be in a court document, and as a result, John Kiriakou is in jail right now.
Hmm. And now, for people who aren't up to their eyebrows in this, John Kiriakou, he's the only CIA officer of any description who's been held to account for the torture program at all. And you're saying it's because he told the name of a torturer, not that he tortured someone. He told the name of a torturer to a lawyer who put it in a classified court document.
Never became public. He's in jail. The torturers are not in jail. And the torturers are not even, the lawyers can't even discuss the torturers at their clients' hearings, at their clients' trials. So, but the point being that it was effective that time by investigating the people who were trying to investigate the torturers, and now the CIA got their effect, which is that their torturers won't be discussed at these trials. Very similar here, it feels to me, that, you know, all of a sudden we're no longer talking about why is the CIA preventing the release of a report, which we know says, A, the torture wasn't effective, and B, says CIA lied to just about everyone, lied to Congress, lied to DOJ, lied to the White House about their torture program. And, you know, we're no longer having that discussion. We're no longer saying that torture report needs to be released now because we've created this sideshow of the Intelligence Committee and the CIA investigating each other and spying on each other and yada, yada, yada.
Right.
When, in point of fact, I mean, this is the Oversight Committee. CIA
right.
is arguing that they have a legal basis tied to the fact that CIA internally agreed, at least to some point, at least to some degree, that their torture wasn't effective and that they may have even agreed that they lied to Congress. I can show that they lied to Congress. The evidence in the public record makes that very clear.
But legally speaking, that's ridiculous, right? They don't have any right to keep secrets from Dianne Feinstein when she is subpoenaing documents or information from them. That's exactly her role, and their role is to say, yes, ma'am, and what am I missing?
You're missing that they, when these conversations happen, say, let's make an agreement. And they say that this violated the terms of the agreement, and golly, no one, you know, if nothing else, it demonstrates how ridiculous our oversight system is, you know, because here you have the people who are supposed to be overseeing who can make this case to avoid being overseen, and it's treated credibly, which, you know, you and I aren't doing it, but everyone else is going, oh, let me see what happened next. And it's like, no, the point of fact is they're trying to stall this torture report that shows that the torture didn't work. And they lied about it not working.
Right.
And they lied about a bunch more.
Although,
they lied about it.
And even then, though, we got to be careful how we define work, because I think work means in the way that the public would imagine it's meant to work to prevent imminent terrorist attacks. But it does work perfectly when you're trying to torture someone into pretending that Saddam Hussein taught him and his al-Qaeda buddies how to make chemical weapons.
Works like a charm if you're trying to get detainees to say what you want.
Right.
And that I think is the big secret. And I think that is the reason why ultimately Obama is offering a fair amount of protection to CIA because, you know, the executive branch and the CIA like having this makeup lies cover and they protect each other that way. And so I think, you know, they want to protect that system. So yeah, that unfortunately is why this is going to work, at least to some degree.
Right. It reminds me of what Julian Assange said over the weekend about how the NSA wears the pants in the Obama administration, which I thought was funny. Same goes for the CIA. Same goes for the fourth branch of government in every administration, as Jacob Hornberger was talking about in his recent piece at FFF there. We'll be right back, everybody, with the great Marcy Wheeler to talk more about the CIA and the NSA and oversight and all the rest of this stuff right after this. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Marcy Wheeler, Empty Wheel, as they call her online. EmptyWheel.net is her website, at Empty Wheel on Twitter there. Read what she tweets, at Empty Wheel. All right, and so now let's see, we're talking about, we're going to get into NSA here in a sec, but we're talking about this fight going on between the Senate Intelligence Committee and the CIA over the various torture reports here, and the joke of what's left of anything like a oversight process in Congress, if we ever really had such a thing since the rise of the national security state. But so let's not be distracted. Let's get right back to the real point then, Marcy, about this 6,000-page torture report. I guess, what all reason do you believe, do you have to believe other than just the quantity of pages there, which I like that number. It's a big, long number. It sounds like a long study, but What reason, if any, do you have to believe that this is going, you know, if it were ever revealed that this has what we really need to know about the CIA's torture program? I mean, other than just the fact that the CIA is freaking out about it, but they'd probably be freaking out no matter what, right?
Well, I mean, they have tried really hard not just to prevent this truth from coming out, but they've done things like approve Jose Rodriguez's book, which is, I mean, and John Rizzo's book, I believe the 60, I counted, something like the 61st word of John Rizzo's book. He was the general counsel of CIA during all, the acting general counsel during all the torture, or during a lot of the torture. And I think it was like at word 61 or something like that, where he finished his first demonstrable lie. That's how full of lies the book is. But the CIA cleared both of those books. So the guy who was in charge of the torture program, the guy who legally approved the torture program, full of all their lies, and didn't approve things like John Kiriakou's book. I mean, pushed back against John Kiriakou's book. And so, in other words, what the CIA has managed to do is release a lot of propaganda. Same thing with Zero Dark 30, right? And Leon Panetta had a role in that, and we know he mm-hmm. was involved in classified, you know, basically leaking classified information in that role. But the CIA has prevented actual truths from being released. So just lies, no truth. And at the very least, this report would counter that. It would provide all of the evidence. I mean, a lot of it is in the public record. I mean, we know that torture with Abu Zubaydah didn't work. We know that he said a bunch of things that weren't true. We know you raised this before, even Sheikh Al-Libi, who was tortured at our behest by the Libyans, or sorry, by the Egyptians, lied about there being a connection between Egypt, between Iraq and Al-Qaeda that the Bush administration used to get us into Iraq. So, you know, perfect example of a lie. He later recanted on his lie. It was proven to be a lie. It was, you know, we know that. That's, as you said, that's what the entire point of the torture program was. There are more. For example, Hassan Gul, the guy who led us to Osama bin Laden, he told us about the courier that led us to Osama bin Laden, and then subsequently we started torturing him. And we don't know what lies he told, but it was a very interesting time to start telling lies, because it was 2004 in the lead up to the election. And mm-hmm. if you recall, they kept going, election, 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 which of course there has to be a terrorist attack to raise the threat level so that right. George Bush can be reelected, even though at that point, I'm not sure a lot of people wanted him to be.
Yeah, so no, I'm sorry to interrupt, but it's just kind of interesting footnote here that Jonathan Landay, who is the lead author on this latest series in McClatchy about this fight between the Intelligence Committee and the CIA, he actually did a study, and I'm sure you have plenty of your own at EmptyWheel.net along these lines too, if I had to guess, but he did a great study in McClatchy newspapers about how the vast majority of the torture took place right before the invasion of Iraq and right after it, and it was certainly as far as you could put together from, you know, the outside without direct admissions from Dick Cheney or something like that. If he didn't prove it, he showed that the purpose clearly was here to get lies about Saddam Hussein, about Saddam's Iraq.
Well, and not only that, but just as an example, every single one of the illegal wiretap program reauthorizations includes language. We never get to see the language. Includes language saying, ooh, scary threat. And that's the entire logic they used to justify this illegal program. They said, the threat is so bad, we need to wiretap, you know, we need to start collecting in the United States. And John Brennan has testified, probably not under oath, but he has testified to Congress that, that some of the information he used in those reports, he was the author of those reports, which I think is really adds a cherry to this whole Sunday of torture.
You're talking, you're
CIA.
Referring to the endless list of orange alerts throughout 02 and 03 and 04 kind of thing. Right,
but those orange alerts were written up into legal documents and given either internally to people at the OLC who reapproved it, or ultimately this phone dragnet we keep talking about. See, I'm segueing you to the NSA very subtly, but this phone dragnet, they had a meeting in 2004 before the judge started. Before the judge approved the internet dragnet, approved this bizarrely overblown definition of quote unquote relevance, and said scary threat, scary threat, scary threat. John Brennan was involved in that too. So So the judge only approved that program after she had been told about all these scary threats. And John Brennan has testified to Congress that he knows he used, he didn't say torture, but he knows he used evidence gotten through the RDI program, and so probably through torture. So they torture people, and then they go to a judge and they say, here's the evidence. They don't say they got it under torture. Here's the evidence that the threat is very scary. And the judge makes a crazy, crazy decision to approve the collection of huge amounts of internet data. And ultimately, that decision would be used to collect, you know, substantially all of the phone data in the United States. So torture, judge makes a terrible decision, phone dragnet. Direct connection.
Amazing. And now we know that the military tortured tens of thousands of Iraqis and Afghanistans in the completely lawless occupations of those countries, at least through, you know, 08 or something. But now, as far as the CIA, and I don't know if you really know, or can you give us a ballpark, your best estimate of how many different people were tortured by the CIA? Was it mostly limited to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi bin al-Shib, or was it hundreds of people, or dozens, or do you know? Not that that would make it okay even to torture that son of a bitch, but...
No, they say 100 people went through the program, and some of those still are disappeared. Some of those, we have no idea where they are, whether they got killed, who knows.
Shallow grave somewhere.
And of course, we know, for example, they killed Gul Rahman, who is a guy who had a tie not even directly to al-Qaeda, but they killed him by hosing him down and leaving him out in freezing temperatures in back in 2002.
Right, in the salt pit. I love that. It's so medieval. It's just amazing.
It is medieval. So 100 people went through the CIA's kind of high-level torture program, but a lot of, I mean, even at Abu Ghraib in Iraq and some of the other people that got killed in Iraq were sort of a joint effort between JSOC and CIA, and they fought for a number of years about who actually, you know, cast the deathly crucifixion or what have you. So the numbers get much bigger when you get outside of outside of the Black Sites program, because there were CIA people involved in other parts of the program.
And we also know, too, from the timelines, right, that some of this torture, I don't know if torture all the way to death or not, but at least some of this torture was taking place before they made up the memos to justify it, right? And so even theory of immunity that you're protected from the memo wouldn't apply to at least some of these cases.
The memos are frankly, in my opinion, the memos are a shiny object to distract us because... Michael Hayden has said publicly, although that when he said it, it promptly got disappeared from whatever TV interview he made. I think it was with MSNBC. He said publicly that the torture program at the beginning was operated solely on a finding, which means solely on presidential authorization.
Right.
And that's, you know, and there's a lot of reasons why we know that that is true. For example, Obama went to unprecedented lengths to keep that detail secret. In the ACLU's torture FOIA, there's a little phrase in a CIA document that George Tenet basically put there as CYA. He basically said, any torture pursuant to the, and the redacted language says something like presidential memorandum of notification from September 17th, 2001, that phrase is classified. And when the judge in the case was about to release it, Obama had his national security advisor, Jim Jones, write a letter. Never happens. Write a letter and get involved in this FOIA case and say, you know, you can't release the fact that this torture program was actually done on presidential authorization. Went to great lengths to prevent that from coming out. Of course, I know about it, but now your listeners know about it.
Yeah.
And that's why I say the memos are largely a shiny object. The torture started, I mean...
But now, where the rubber meets the road, though, the Justice Department invoked those memos to say, hey, look, everybody, shiny object, and then stopped their even preliminary investigation into even these murders that took place at CIA hands, correct?
Correct.
So this is a very substantive shiny object. It's a shiny shield that they really use.
Well, no. Let me say one more thing. Is for example, two details. One, so Gul Rahman, I already mentioned.
Talk
him,
real fast. Killed.
Okay. They didn't use the memos we always talk about to excuse themselves. They used an earlier memo written by John Yoo that wasn't approved all the way up to the top of the chain at OLC.
I got you. All right, well, and I'm sorry I didn't get to ask you all the great Snowden stuff I wanted to ask you, because there's all kinds of new revelations there. But anyway, thank you so much for your time. I'm sorry I wasted the beginning of your interview ranting about CNN's pot coverage, but it just made me angry.
All right, take care.
But thank you very much, Marcy, for coming on the show. I appreciate it, as always.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right, but that's the great Marcy Wheeler. EmptyWheel.net, and follow her on Twitter, too, at EmptyWheel. And we'll be back with Grant F. Smith right after this. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. And it looks like I just missed Jonathan Lande. We'll see if we can get him on the show tomorrow. That'll be fun. He's the guy who was trying to truth you out of war back in 2002, if only you were reading Knight Ridder stories. He was right in the Office of Special Projects, close, man, in August of 02. So that's pretty good. That's called way, way ahead of the curve. Anyway, our next guest is Grant F. Smith from the Institute for Research Middle East Policy. And he is the author of a great many books, America's Defense Line, and a bunch of others, including Divert, Numek, Zalman Shapiro, and the Diversion of U.S. Weapons-Grade Uranium into the Israeli Nuclear Weapons Program. That's the latest. Welcome back to the show, Grant. How are you doing?
Hey, Scott, doing fine. A little tired, I suspect you are, too.
Nah, I'm fine, man.
Covering. Okay, that's good.
Thank you very much for inviting me out to this conference. It was the National Summit to Reassess the U.S.-Israel Special Relationship. It took place at the National Press Club on Friday, put on by your group and Phil Giraldi's group, the Council for the National Interest, and If Americans Knew, and the Washington Report for Middle Eastern Affairs. And am I leaving anyone out?
No, you've got them all. It was four organizations all collaborating and pulling together as many good speakers and panels as we could possibly fit into a short slot, and we all thank you for coming out and moderating what was probably the most difficult panel of them all. So that was good, and also kicking off the event.
Yeah, well, I had a great time doing it, and I really appreciate y'all having me out. And
good.
I have my list here. I kind of jotted down. I'm not going to go through it, but I think it's probably a dozen people who have been sort of long-distance radio acquaintances or friends of mine for many years now that I was finally able to meet in person. And so, and then of course, I got to see you and Gareth Porter and Karen Kotowski and Ray McGovern again, but that was still nice too. So,
well, that was part of the point. I mean, the idea was that this wasn't just, you know, a bunch of people speaking from the 10 inch riser, but that people would come and talk to each other and have a little bit more personal contact than we normally do in this, you know, digital age. And I feel the same way you do. There are people who I've never met, but I've known their work for many, many years. And they suddenly, there they all are in the same room and looking around. And I thought it was a fantastic opportunity, you know, when we weren't rushing to get the next presentation up, to go and talk to people.
Yeah, that's the joke I should have cracked at the beginning was, if you want to know about my show, I basically interview all the people you're going to see give speeches today.
Right.
With a few new ones, you know, a few people I've never talked to before up there, but it was sort of like a best of the Scott Horton Show, only live in a way, up there.
Exactly,
really
exactly. I mean, it was kind of a reunion for you in some respects, and I felt we almost should have kicked it up by saying, you know, the reason there's no Wi-Fi here is we're not going to do any social media. We're going to go back to socializing, and we're going to talk to each other and look at each other's name tags and connect namespaces and work. So, yeah. You know, it was really, you know, a really interesting experience, particularly outside the conference hall where people were really getting into some intense discussions.
Right. Okay, so now let's talk about the coverage. Of course, C-SPAN covered the whole thing live. Was it on C-SPAN or 2 or 3, or it doesn't really matter?
It matters. It was on C-SPAN 3. As far as I could tell, they didn't do a live radio broadcast, but they wouldn't normally do something that long live on C-SPAN radio, which is only really here in Washington and the surrounding area. But it's been, since then, it's been split up into segments. It was on C-SPAN 2 and C-SPAN as well. In fact, I particularly enjoyed yesterday on C-SPAN, they had Benjamin Netanyahu's speech, and then they segued directly to Paul Pillar's point-by-point debunking of virtually everything that the prime minister had just said at AIPAC.
Really?
And I thought that was something, I mean, that's the reason we have mass media right there, is to get both sides of the story like that. And quite frankly, I've never seen anything so valuable and timely spliced together like that.
Well, you know, I've long respected Brian Lamb and the whole C-SPAN project, because I think they really try to have a professional, agnostic attitude about opinions on these political issues. And, you know, what's a qualification for them is, if this seems like it's a big and legitimate enough, you know, typical American participation in the democratic process, they point their cameras at it. They don't care, you know. They try very hard, I think, not to favor. And of course, they have their mainstream biases because, you know, they live in D.C. and they're the creatures right of that kind of process. But they always seem to have been very fair-minded. I mean, for example, even showing up, and then especially, like you're saying, well, you know, earlier there was this CIA guy who gave a speech that kind of disagreed with that. Let's go ahead and play that, you know. And I think they just have that sort of easygoing attitude about it that makes that kind of thing possible, you know.
Well, I think you're right to a certain extent. You know, typically though, you're getting to see the highly, you know, professional, you know, logo wall backdrop presentations coming from a very limited point of view that's high, you know, it's got a lot of financing. And then the other guys are in the back room of a bookstore, you know, with a scruffy podium and maybe a little less polished. So it doesn't always look good. It doesn't always have the effect. And quite frankly, there aren't that many of them. They broadcast, you know, a lot of think tank gatherings here in Washington, and most of the local radio stations that really have a lot of content about foreign policy, like WAMU at American University, it's always the same people and the same viewpoints. They very rarely mix up their journalist panels on the Diane Rehm show and other shows. So it's, you know, C-SPAN does a good job, but, you know, between the saturation of the think tanks that are already here, and relative rarity of this type of event, people don't see too much of it.
Right. Well, we just got to compete with them better. We need more more CNIs and more ear MIPS. Because really, I mean, this is really the great success of the neoconservative movement, was to not just occupy, you know, I don't know, 60 or 80 people in the whole country, occupy, you know, all the major editorial boards. There's at least one good, reliable neocon on every editorial board, on every major paper. And then they created just, I mean, a lot of these think tanks exist only in Bill Kristol's desk drawer, you know, but they're still, you know, there's a dozen of them, and they create this wonderful echo chamber for whatever Netanyahu wants.
Yeah, I think people are getting wise to that. And I was, you know, you mentioned that takeover, Scott McConnell's presentation about sort of the gatekeeping and how people were suddenly answering to Midge Dector, you know, over at Buckley's shop was very illuminating. And, you know, it was very detailed, but it provided sort of the same snapshot of gatekeeping and limiting debates that you also find on the other side, on the left as well. And those were two panels, you know, again, on the segment that you moderated. Panel 5 has the lobby capture political parties and the news media. They really got into some brass tacks, no hold barred looks at what's happened. And one of the things that I think worked well was that people had to get to the point. One of the things that happens a lot in this sort of discussion is that people think they have a lot of time to make their point, and we made sure they didn't, so that they would get to the point. Mm-hmm. And everybody did with just, you know, aplomb, and I think that worked very well. But I wanted to mention that at the natsummit.org website, we've got half of the audio up now in MP3 format so that people can download individual segments and listen to them because that's not available at C-SPAN, which has the video. And we should have the rest of them up by later today. So people can go in and kind of download to their podcast listeners, devices, virtually every panel and every speaker. So that should be good for people who want to review some of these things.
Mm-hmm. And then will all the different speeches be up on YouTube at some point too?
Yes. One of the things, again, that C-SPAN doesn't do that we're doing is putting the slides into the presentations mm-hmm. so that people can kind of treat it like a classroom. And so at some point, embeddable video, which is not currently the case, embeddable video by the end of the week or weekend should be available so that people can kind of, chew this stuff over a little bit on their own websites and look at the slides. So,
well, listen, I think it was a great success. I mean, you had a ton of people. A great list, and we're going to go down a list when we get back of speakers who talked about a great range of subjects. And also, it was a packed house. I don't know, 300, 350 people, something like that, filled up a big room there at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. I think it was absolutely a successful event in a lot of ways. And I want to talk to you about some of the different ways. What maybe we could have accomplished there, what we can do going forward from here. It's Grant Smith from the Institute for Research Middle East Policy, IRMEP.org, and we'll be right back after this. On March 7th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., the Council for the National Interest is co-hosting the first ever national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Confirmed speakers include Walt Scheuer, Giraldi, McGovern, Katowski, Porter, McConnell, Weiss, Raimondo, USS Liberty survivor Ernie Gallo, as well as co-sponsors Alison Ware of If Americans Knew and the great Grant Smith of the Institute for Research Middle East Policy. That's the national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Friday, March the 7th, all day at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. NatSummit.org. On CNN, they got James Kallstrom, the head of the Flight 800 cover-up for the FBI, giving the definitive take on this new missing plane crash. Whatever you say, Jimmy. Hey, Rush Limbaugh said that if you said so, I have to believe it. Hey, he's Jimmy Kallstrom. I know this guy. You can trust him. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Grant F. Smith, the author of Divert, about the Israelis stealing weapons-grade uranium from the United States of America to make their nuclear weapons to threaten the rest of the Middle East with. And he's the director of IRMEP, the Institute for Research Middle East Policy. What he does is he goes to court and he makes the government give him documents about the history of Israeli policy in the United States. And great stuff, IRMEP.org. Go digging through that stuff and you'll be wide-eyed and jaw-dropped, I promise. Now, Grant, and along with Phil Giraldi and Alison Ware and others, put together this great thing that took place Friday in Washington, D.C. at the press club there. It was the National Summit to Reassess the U.S.-Israel Special Relationship. There's a great list of speakers and a wide variety of topics covered, historical and contemporary, and the lobby here and the Palestinians there, and Iran's so-called alleged studies documents on that forged laptop and all the rest. It was really something else. Why don't you go through, tell us, I don't know, who was your favorite speaker? Is that unfair?
I couldn't name a favorite because one of the fallacies, I think, is that people who work in this field know a lot about everything, and I felt, pretty stupid listening to a lot of these because I had never heard a lot of some of the really fine points. So
oh,
I like them all, and
no doubt.
And I was sitting in the back listening and learning as much as anybody else. But there was definitely some surprising points, and I can't even really name a favorite. I like them all.
All right, well, so let's go through chronological order then, and let's pick some highlights. I guess we can't talk about each and every speaker, but, give people a reason to want to go and look this thing up on cspan.org and on natsummit.org.
Okay, well, sure. I think I would actually almost go in reverse chronological order, because I thought the anchoring panel, the intelligence panel, which you boosted that several times on C-SPAN, saying, don't go away, don't go away, and it was extremely important to have that. Paul Pilar did just an absolutely stunning job. He went through every single one of these sort of false narratives that's coming out of Israel about securing, you know, the Western frontier the Eastern frontier and all of these Iranian threats. And he basically tore them all apart while explaining what a U.S. ally really would be like and how it's in the Israelis' interest to get behind the negotiations. And I just found that, you know, again, I've read his things, but I've never heard him speak live, and that was fascinating. Ray McGovern, very interesting. He's always good on your show, but he did bring in some hard points about how assassinations in Gaza, you know, affected the fatally flawed and ridiculous U.S. invasion of Iraq to an even harsher degree. And, of course, Philip Giraldi at the end making a very sincere and abbreviated summary that he doesn't believe the U.S. has an ally in Israel. So I thought that was extremely powerful, that entire segment. But then, you know, right before it was your panel. And you had Jeff Blankford talking about how a lot of people have been mesmerized by a very limited analysis of Israel as it fits into the U.S. sort of national security and defense policy. You had Alan Braunfeld, who's just a very eloquent speaker from the American Committee on Judaism, talking about how Zionism has evolved inside social welfare organizations. Justin Raimondo, who did this really interesting recap on the rights and the Israel lobby and how it's kind of come 180 degrees. Scott McConnell, we talked about earlier, and then, of course, the inimitable Philip Weiss talking about everything
cool?
from...
I love that guy, man.
He is so cool, yeah. Everything from blogging and hauling out his six guns when he heard about Mearsheimer and Wall to some very, very poignant ideas about how the media is changing. Most bloggers, you just think of them as being people who are excelling behind a keyboard, but he's a very, very interesting speaker. So I thought that was a treat. But then before that, then we had a history panel where Stephen Waltz not only recapped what he said along with John Mearsheimer and what he didn't say in his book, which was just as important, but he was followed by Jeffrey Warrow, who has this fascinating book called Quicksand, which kind of explains the U.S. position in the Middle East right now. Very eloquent. He had a lot of terrain to cover, and he did it very well.
Yeah, that was a really interesting speech there. That was the guy that talked about the history of the founding of Israel from what he learned going through all the formerly secret documents of the Americans and the British
right.
on the issue at the time and what they were saying to each
right.
other about it and that kind of thing.
Right, and
yeah.
he didn't have time to go
really
into some of the treatment of his book. I mean, that's a Penguin book. People should buy Quicksand and read it. It hasn't gotten the reception that it should have gotten. And then, of course, John Quigley going over international law and how the U.S. Support for Israel's ongoing occupation is damaging its credibility. And Allison, we were talking about her research from her book Against Our Better Judgment. So that was another longer panel, very historically based. And, of course, before that was probably the best example of a panel that was moving at light speed, because I think everybody hit their mark of 13 minutes. In fact, one of the speakers even said, hey, I'm done 13 seconds early, like we're going to give him a
right.
prize. But it was about whether the special relationship transcends rule of law. And so I went through basically the things I talk about on your show, how a lot of espionage cases, foreign agent cases, smuggling cases just were never prosecuted, and what was going on inside the Justice Department. Ernie Geller, who was on the USS Liberty, talked about, you know, the treatment of that whole episode.
Everybody, you got to see that one. Gallo, the USS Liberty survivor. Show that to your Zionist brother-in-law and see what he thinks of that, man. Come on.
Everyone stood up and applauded and gave a standing ovation after he got done with his presentation.
That was something else. And then the guy, what's his name? The FBI agent from the counterintelligence division who put together the case against Jonathan Pollard. I don't know how you got him to show up at this thing, but that was just incredible.
Yeah, that was Spike Bowman, and he talked about the Jonathan Pollard affair. And although it didn't quite get through my thick head, I never understood that he's the one who wrote Caspar Weinberger's memorandum in aid of sentencing that got Jonathan Pollard the life sentence. And I still didn't quite understand that until I realized at the end of the panel that I've been trying to get his document declassified for 10 years, and I followed up on that with him, and he said, don't ever expect to see the classified portion. So it was really interesting to have somebody sitting there saying, yeah, we know about the Freedom of Information Act, and we know how to write these things so that some portions will just never be declassified. So I learned a lot there. But,
right, he really did explain that, didn't he? In kind of plain English, we write it in ways where it'll never be declassified if we want it that way.
But it wasn't condescending. It was just very, very straight.
And now, I'm sorry, because we're running really short on time, and we don't have time to go down the whole list. I guess I got to stop you there. But I hope that people are rushing to C-SPAN.org and finding this thing and bookmarking it. It's the National Summit to Reassess the U.S.-Israel Special Relationship. You'll be able to find, as he already said, audio is available at natsummit.org, and there's video at C-SPAN.org, and soon it'll be coming out on YouTube and all that. But I wanted to ask you, here at the very end, I guess we've got a couple of minutes, Grant. What do you think about the future of this, or what do you think that this conference means, in the scheme of things, as far as advancing this topic of having an open and honest political debate, just like we do have on virtually every other issue in this country, really, no matter how controversial. I mean, we even talk about the government selling drugs and stuff like that sometimes on C-SPAN, but this is sort of a first, something like this. But so do we really, break some ice? Are we really going to move forward from here, you think?
I think so. I think there's a role in the natural space in the same week that AIPAC has its annual policy conference for another loose coalition of individuals to come together. Again, people who don't necessarily agree on everything, but to come together and talk about what's happening for the rest of the United States and the rest of the interests. And I think it's something that a lot of people are interested in. We're quite frankly still gathering data and feedback, the survey and of opinions about this is not complete. But I'll be asking you what you think of it and asking others. I think we still need to collect information. But, I mean, clearly there's a place for everybody who feels as though we're on the wrong track, and that's a number that's getting bigger every day, to gather and hear some briefings and then be able to self-organize and move ahead after. So I definitely see the promise that this would not be the last one.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think the thing went real well, and it's silly, and it's, Stephen Walt pointed out, I was talking about this earlier on the show, Stephen Walt said, they called us Nazis after we wrote our article, and then we got a book deal. So it was even then, right, as harsh as it was, the attacks on Walton Mearsheimer, that whole frenzy against him, it didn't really stand against them, and I think they really helped move the ball forward a lot. And then with this, I mean, come on. All we're talking about is honest debate about our country and their country and whatever. Nobody's bigots here. This isn't about any nefarious thing. This is it's nothing like anybody would put in an accusation. It's just well, like I was saying in the context of C-SPAN earlier, just plain old Americans participating in the democratic process exactly like is supposed to be the deal. So too long ignored, but whose time has come for sure. So thanks, Grant.
Absolutely.
I really appreciate it.
Okay, Scott, thanks for coming.
All right, everybody. That's the great Grant Smith. Institute for Research Middle East Policy. That's IRMEP.org. The latest book is Divert. And check out natsummit.org and cspan.org for the footage and the audio there. And we'll be right back with Ted Snyder in just a sec. Hey, all, Scott here, inviting you to check out Modern Times Magazine at moderntimesmagazine.com. It's a great little independent publication out of Phoenix, Arizona, featuring unique views on economics, politics, foreign policy, sports, and music, with great art scene coverage and fiction writing as well. That's Modern Times Magazine at moderntimesmagazine.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is my website. Keep all my interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. And, of course, we're here live from 3 to 5 Eastern Time, Monday through Friday, on the Liberty Express. And our next guest today is Ted Snyder. He's been writing lately for Antiwar.com. Quite a few good ones there. This one is Ukraine and 21st Century Coups. Welcome back to the show, Ted. How are you doing?
Hi, Scott. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Very good to have you here. And, first of all, why don't you start with the same place you start in the article? A little bit of background about this sort of American patent, the great successes, if you can call them that, short-term successes anyway, of the CIA, lo, these many years in overthrowing other people's governments short of Iraq-style invasion regime changes here.
Right. So what I've been looking at, Scott, is what seems to me to be a paradigm shift in coups since Obama became president. By their nature, coups are, they're secret. By their nature, a coup is a secret way of removing a government. But it seems that under the Obama administration, coups have become so secret that they're not even recognized to have happened. So in the third quarter of the 20th century, from the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, you get coups in places like Iran and Guatemala and Chile, but there seem to be coups because they end with tanks on the streets and gunshots and violent changes of government. What seems to be happening under Obama is that we're getting these changes of government, but rather than tanks being used as weapons, it's like democracy is being wielded as a weapon because the coups look like constitutional, democratic things that happen in parliaments. And so they're not even seen to have happened until you look more closely at the patterns and see that these democratic coups are actually coups in the disguise of democracy.
So, where, say, in Iran in 1953, the CIA rent these mobs to cause chaos in order to make the case that Mossadegh couldn't control the chaos. In this case, it's when the Shah comes back, you can tell that, that was basically an excuse. Like you say, the tanks come out and he's got to use the iron hand to stay in power and all of that. That in these cases, what they're doing is they're whipping up the crowds and then just pretending that this is the majority. They deserve the power that they're getting, even if they're the people who lost the last election.
So I think, Scott, two things are happening here. And one of them we talked about on your last show because it was especially relevant in Egypt at the time, and now the second one's becoming relevant because of Ukraine. So what you had in 53 in Iran and 54 in Guatemala is, the American hand getting mobs in the street looking like disorder, governments have lost control, and that justifies the domestic military stepping in and restoring order where there was the appearance of none. So it starts off as covert, but it ends up overt, it ends up visible. Then what you get now is you get this idea that you can get these mobs in the street, and all these changes lately that we're happening, we're seeing in Venezuela, in Iran, in Brazil, Turkey, Egypt, Ukraine, they all have these mass protests in the street. But if you look closely, the numbers in the street, the people in the street, they're the same people that lost in the polls. And one of the features of democracy is it's the majority or the largest minority, and not the unanimity that gets to choose the government. So if you have a government losing an election, so the government wins an election, the losing side has, 40% of the vote, that's too small to elect a government. But it's a massive number of people in the street. And in the polls, you're silent. But the noise that number can make on the street makes it look like a huge social democratic movement. So we get these huge movements of people who are really just the same people that lost at the polls, trying to achieve on the street what they couldn't achieve on the polls. And then one of three things happens. either the domestic military steps in and restores order. That's what happened in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. At the end of the 20th century, you get this new model. Noam Chomsky called it humanitarian imperialism. And then Dana Johnson wrote about it in her book on Yugoslavia, Fool's Crusade, because she says it came up in Yugoslavia, where you get this realization that any minority group who lost in the polls don't have the strength to win an election, don't have the strength to get their own military on their side, so they can't change the government through elections or military, has to create a situation to invite another military, an outside military, to come in. So what you do is you create the appearance of a humanitarian crisis. And that justifies America or NATO coming in on the grounds of a humanitarian crisis. So we saw that in Kosovo, you know, in the Ukraine. We've seen that attempted in Syria and Libya. You're seeing a similar thing being tried in the streets of Venezuela today. So that's the second way. The third way, if you're not creating this look of the minority in the polls being the majority in the street, is this model of making it look like the constitutional shufflings of parliament. So you make a coup look like something that just happened in the parliament. So I think the first time we saw this under Obama was in Honduras.
Mm-hmm.
So in Honduras, you get the democratically elected president, Zelaya. He gets kidnapped, whisked out at gunpoint, flown out. And what happens then is after he's kidnapped in this coup is you get the Supreme Court declaring his actions unconstitutional, and you get the Congress voting to remove him. So it looks all very constitutional. In fact, it's not, and U.S. Embassy cables show that they knew full well this was a coup. The cables say that, and the cable, by the way, was called, if there's any doubt, the cable, the U.S. Embassy cable, was called Open and Shut, the case of the Honduran coup, right? So this is like an almost comic lack of subtlety that they clearly thought nobody would see. But in it, they say there's no doubt the Supreme Court and the Congress conspired an illegal and constitutional coup. So they knew about it.
And by the way, this is just a small footnote. Sorry to interrupt, but isn't it the case that at the time Obama said, hey, yeah, that's not right. I don't know if he used the C word or not, but he said, hey, yeah, you can't do that. And then Hillary Clinton said, yeah, you can. And then Obama backed down because it was Hillary Clinton and her friend Lanny Davis was, you know, working for the coup guys or something like that,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, State Department and the White House had different messages on this. They never did officially call it a coup. They never withdrew their ambassador. They never suspended all the funding. They recognized the coup government. They pressured the Organization of American States to recognize the coup government. The guys that were involved in this were the same guys that were involved in the 2002 Venezuelan coup. So this was a coup, but what it looked like was the Supreme Court saying that what Zelaya was doing was unconstitutional. Zelaya introduced a plebiscite. He was asking the Hondurans, do you want a new constitution? One of the questions in the constitution was going to be, should a president be allowed to stand for a second term? What happened is the opposition said that what Zelaya did was he said he was going to stand for a second term. The court said that's illegal. The Congress voted. They whisked him out. So to the world, this looks like the Supreme Court saying what you're doing is wrong, the Congress voting him out. But in fact, what looks like a parliamentary thing is a set-up coup. You know,
well, that's sort of the Chile model from the Allende coup, right?
Yeah, with Allende, though, you eventually do get, you know, violence in the streets and stuff. So
sure.
It's something that's seen more. So Honduras is totally subtle. No one notices this is a coup, right? And then shortly later in Paraguay, so we're still in Latin America, you get the exact same thing happen. In fact, people call this one a parliamentary coup. So what you get in Paraguay is the same thing. You get a president there, and you get this skirmish over disputed land where a number of people get killed. The opposition blames it on the government, and they charge him with doing that. And then what they do is they give him 24 hours to prepare a defense. They give him 2 hours on the floor of the parliament to defend. They vote against him and kick him out. But it looks like parliament, right? It looks like a guy talking in parliament. It looks like parliament voting him out. What you don't see is that the charges against him are completely illegitimate. And again, we get American embassy cables saying they're fully aware on this, that they're aware of what they call capitalizing on Lugo's missteps. They talk about a plan to impeach him, quote, legally, but on spurious grounds. So you get this whole sort of thing again that it looks like parliament, but it's really a coup. And then again, you get all the South American states not recognizing this government. OAS kicks them out. Mercosur kicks them out. But you get the Americans recognizing the coup government and pressuring to get them back in. So again, you see this parliamentary move with the U.S. recognizing the government, getting them back into international bodies. But it's not a parliamentary move. It's something that the cable show they know full well is a coup, that it was completely spurious grounds. So we get these models where you're evicting governments under the guise of the shuffling of parliament, but what you've really got is a coup. What I'm looking at in this paper that I just did with Anti-War is that perhaps this is what's happening in Ukraine, that we see again something that looks parliamentary but could be a coup. And in order to establish that, you'd have to establish two things. One is that it was actually a coup, that it looked parliamentary, was actually a coup. And then the second thing you'd have to establish is that, at least in part, there's an American hand behind this. So what I'm looking at in the paper, you know, Ukraine and 21st Century Coups, is there evidence that what looked like a change in the configuration of the parliament was actually a coup? And in part, can an American hand be found behind this coup? Does it look like Honduras and Paraguay?
Well, and of course, okay, well, first of all, we're about to have to take a break here in just about a minute and a half, so I want to save the evidence. I want to, you know, go let you go down the list of evidence and make your cases as well as you can there. But, you know, it brings up, of course, the question of the current crisis now with the apparent secession of Crimea, which is, I guess, in progress, but it looks like they're going to leave Ukraine and rejoin Russia. The Russian parliament has already agreed to take them back, I think. I don't know. I mean, it's not a done deal yet, but I think they're having a plebiscite in Crimea in a few weeks or something.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is a really big deal the way this has played out. There's, you know, some real risk of a civil war inside Ukraine, or maybe the, you know, the violent splitting of the country. And of course, America and Russia are at the highest alert type of face-off that they've been since the end of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
And not that I'm trying to be too alarmist and say, oh, we're on the verge of nuclear war or anything, but it's a big, stupid fight that I disapprove of. And I think that, you know, most people would prefer, in fact, the polls are saying that, 14% of the American people are saying that they think it's our responsibility to determine outcomes in Ukraine one way or the other, militarily or otherwise. But so, you know, for people who aren't, you know, following the news that closely, this is not just an academic exercise about, you know, how the CIA and the NED get things done in the world. But it's also, you know, a lesson in consequences and possible very severe mass extinction type threatening consequences at play. And also, I guess this is what I was going to say before I forgot there for a minute, Ted, was that responsibility is kind of a vague concept. It's a matter of quality, not quantity. There's no real scale of 1 to 10. So, of course, there's always going to be, like you talked about, losers of the last election, but who really are from there and who probably have, I mean, after all, if they live under a government, they must have some real grievances about how their government is forcing them to live. And so it's not to diminish the right of people to overthrow their government or the will of real Ukrainians to do so. But we do have to point out of which states have the real power in the world and can really make these things happen or not. And so I'm sorry for talking so long, but we're going to take this break, and then it's going to be your turn when we get back. It's Ted Snyder, antiwar.com today. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right of the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Everybody knows George Washington was just a sock puppet of the French. Getting their regime changed, humiliating the British there, Yorktown. Anyway, I don't know. These things are all matters of perspective and all that. Ted Snyder, he's written this article, Ukraine 21st Century Coups. It's at antiwar.com today. And do you have any comment about either, one, the danger that we're in because of this that I was going on and on about, or two, any kind of subtle point to make about degrees of responsibility for Western intervention in Ukraine as it coincides with the wishes of the people on the street of whichever factions there.
You know, I think the thing is, when you look at the wishes of the people on the street, you've got to look at the idea of, Yanukovych getting elected in 2010 by an election that was considered, you know, fair by international observers. And then you look at, are the people in the street saying something different than the people in the polls? Has there been a change? If there's been a change, right, then maybe there'd be a change in election or a change of government. But the thing is, all the polls that have been taken, both by Americans, by the British, by the Ukrainians, the polls show that when you ask people who they wanted to go with, the economic union with Russia or the economic with union with Europe, the numbers are exactly the same as the numbers in 2010. You know, they're split. So what looks like this change, it wasn't a change, right? So it doesn't change the electoral result. It doesn't overturn it. There was this illusion of this call for change, but the people asking for change were the same people that lost. So, you know, is there a responsibility to go in and protect or correct some kind of, you know, imbalance or change? The thing is, there wasn't a change. So then you look at, if there wasn't a change, then how did this happen, right? Was it a coup, and was there U.S. involvement? And that's, I think, where you'd want to look at the evidence and ask, was this really not a change in public opinion, but was this really a coup that was assisted or orchestrated from outside because we changed what we wanted in the Ukraine, not that Ukrainians changed what they wanted in the Ukraine?
Right. Okay. So now let's go through the evidence here, because I think it's really important going forward. Of course, the media narrative for any foreign policy crisis is always that history began yesterday and you don't need to understand
right.
the context of any of this. So this show
right.
is supposed to be the antidote for that. So as we go forward here, I think it's important. I think this is your motivation for writing this article. Let's go ahead and make sure we've got all the best evidence we have so far, at least in one place. If people want to refute it, that's great. Let them try. But make the case for what all is known about American intervention in this regime change in Ukraine.
Okay, so we have two things. The first is, you have to look at, was it a coup, and or was it just parliament? And the second was, if it was a coup, was America or Europe involved? So I'll go.
And you
got to
look at the clock. We got 9 minutes.
Yeah, we
go
got
ahead.
9 minutes. So I'll move fast, but. This is the heart of the idea. Was it a coup? So the first thing, it happens in three stages. The first thing you have is that the security forces decide to stop protecting government buildings, and they allow the protesters to come into the government buildings, to take over the government buildings. Now that you've got them in there, you get an opposition that wants to change the government. So they seize upon timing.
And so it was the parliament that was the boss of the security forces. Is that right?
Well, it's complicated. You know, a couple of things happen. One is, you get this sort of, Yanukovych agreed that he would share power, move elections forward, and pull back security, and you got the mob taking advantage of that. There was also Victoria Nuland having a meeting with the wealthiest of the Ukrainian oligarchs and telling him that if you violently oppose the people of the street, if you oppose them, we're not just going to sanction Ukraine, we're going to sanction you, Ukrainian business. So the guy that funds Yanukovych's party is threatened not to let the security police block anybody. So is there a connection there? I don't know. The timing's good. They pull back. The mobs get into the parliament. At the time it happened, at the very moment it happened, most of the MPs for the eastern and southern Ukraine, and they're the ones that would side with Yanukovych, they're not there because they're at a congress of politicians in another part of Ukraine. So when all these votes happened to kick Yanukovych out, his supporters weren't there to cast their ballots. But what you do have is these sort of fascist thugs that had come in off the street from, you know, Svoboda and Right Factor, and they're walking around there, and so Yanukovych's supporters, they're fleeing for their lives. And the third thing that happens is, with that kind of intimidation, you get these votes happening, replacing the president, replacing the parliament. So it looks like parliamentary votes, right? But the guys who would vote against it had either were not there or were chased out, the police stopped protecting it, people come in. It's actually a coup. And then, because I guess we're running out of time, and then you look quickly at, you know, how was this contributed from the outside. One of the really interesting things is that I think that the West set the triggers that set this thing going, because this is always presented as Yanukovych abandoned an economic union with Russia, with Europe, and sided instead with an economic union with Russia. What no one tells us is that it was the states in Europe that told Ukraine, you've got to pick one or the other. They said, if you pick Europe, you can't deal with Russia. Mm-hmm. Putin didn't do that. Putin told them, there's no reason why you can't have both of us helping you. So the West sets this terms that you've got to choose one or the other, Europe or Russia. And then they make it impossible to choose Europe because the deal has such stringent austerity measures that it would crash the Ukrainian economy. But the second thing, which doesn't get talked about at all, is that it also included what they called security policies that subordinated Ukraine to NATO. Mm-hmm. So first they say, pick Europe or Russia. But if you pick Europe, austerity measures are going to collapse you, and you've got to be subordinate to NATO. So pick Europe or Russia, but you can't pick Europe. It forces Yanukovych to pick Russia, so he can't choose the West. He picks Russia, and that sets the stage for the protest. So now you have a protest in the street. So the next thing you do is you protect and you nurture the protest.
So either they're brilliantly Machiavellian or they're completely ridiculously stupid.
I don't think this one was stupid. I think they knew they had a country divided, and whichever one Yanukovych picked, the other side was going to be really upset. So they set the stage to make the side they wanted upset. And then immediately America's on the ground supporting the protest. John McCain's there whipping them up. Victoria Nuland's there whipping them up. You provide cover to the protest on the street by criticizing not the people throwing, Molotov cocktails and violently trying to change a democratic government. You criticize the government for trying to stop this violent coup in the street. So you give legitimacy to the protest. Then the next thing you do is you find out that we've been financing the protest. The National Endowment for Democracy is funding 65 organizations inside the Ukraine. And Victoria Nuland, boasted to the Ukrainian Foundation conference that the States has given $5 billion in assistance to these pro-democracy movements in Ukraine. So you trigger the protest, you protect the protest, you give it legitimacy, you finance it, and then we get this intercepted phone message from Victoria Nuland that the sensationalist Western media just focuses on her vocabulary. She said a dirty word. And what they miss is this plotting to decide who's going to be in. And the guy they picked, Yatsenyuk, is indeed in. But the most important line was Victoria Nuland telling the ambassador of Ukraine that the West needs to, quote, midwife this thing. And, in my article, I call that a metaphorical admission of America's role in the coup, where they're midwifing it. And at one point, she even says in it that, Biden's willing to do the midwifery. So you get
she says glue it, too. We got to glue this thing together.
Yeah, they talk about needing the UN to glue it to get mm-hmm. Europe out. But, this key line is this admission that we're midwifing the coup. We've picked the guy we want in. So that's all. So what we get is this evidence that it really did look like there had been a shift in the parliament, and it really did look like Yanukovych's guys had come over to the side and voted him out. But in fact, it wasn't that. It wasn't a vote at all for the reasons I gave earlier. Mm. And then we see this very much an American hand in it, admitting to midwifing it, at least in part financing it, backing it up in the streets, providing it cover. And what you get is a situation that looks exactly like what we saw in Honduras and Paraguay. And that's the thrust of the article. It's not, I'm not just saying something about Ukraine. I'm saying there is this pattern here that we can see of this new kind of coup that looks like a shuffling in parliament, but in fact has, the hidden hand behind it that it's a coup so subtle that it's not even seen to be a coup. It's seen to be democracy in action, and it wields democracy as a weapon against democracy.
Right. And then, in this case, it really is amazing, as you say, since this phone call was leaked, where, some of these people, media people, they heard the whole phone call and understood what it was. I mean,
absolutely.
After all, even the most superficial coverage is, why is she cursing the EU? Not because they're on Russia's side. She's cursing the EU because they're not moving fast and effectively enough in regime changing the government in Ukraine. Simple as that.
And what you get is a Western media that catches on to two things. One is, Nuland swore, and the other is, look, the Russians intercepted a phone call. Ironic,
yeah.
Given everything that's going on. Sensationalism about the intercept and the F word, there's barely a Western media that talked about her straight up saying, we're orchestrating this coup, here's the guy we want in, here's who we want him talking about, we need to send somebody. I mean, you've got this phone call that's an admission of a U.S. coup in Ukraine, And all the papers talk about is Victoria Nuland's war.
And listen, you know, I think that you made the most important point about the regime change here is what you said about the sanctions. That they told the billionaires there, look, if you don't forsake this guy right now, we're going to seize your bank account. And at that point, the guys that support the Party of Regions, Yanukovych's party, the billionaires, some of the billionaires, one faction of them anyway, or a collection of them, they decide, all right, you got to go, pal, and they quit supporting him for their end in the parliament too. And that was really the end of that, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
and that's why I feel bad, because I got people on my Facebook page saying, no, man, the people on the street really hated that guy. And I'm going, yeah, okay, but they're not the ones who overthrew him. You know, it would be like if you had an Occupy movement and then Petraeus overthrew Obama. You going to give the Occupy movement credit for that? I don't think so, you know?
Yeah, and Scott, maybe they did hate him, and none of what I'm saying is to say that Yanukovych was a good president. I mean, I'm not defending him, and I'm sure some of the grievances that were there were real, but it wasn't those grievances that you know, escalated the coup. It wasn't those grievances that took over on the street. It was the maneuvering that used this shift to the Russian Union as an excuse. And that shift was sort of compelled by the West and then seized upon, and other forces took over on the streets. And we see all the time, you know, we saw that in Egypt too, with a movement starting as a genuine movement and then getting hijacked and used as a coup in another way. And there too, it looked like, you know, they tried to make it look like democracy.
Mm-hmm. Well, they lose sometimes, like in Egypt, but then only for about a year and a half, and then they won Egypt back. They took over and hijacked the revolution in Libya and in Syria, and I guess they'll just keep moving on. At least, here's where we are today, at least they're not doing full-scale invasions like Iraq for now.
Mm-hmm.
But meanwhile, the regime changes just keep rolling on and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Ted. You do a great job writing about this stuff. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Scott.
All right, everybody. That's Ted Snyder. He's at antiwar.com today. Ukraine and 21st century coups. And that's it. We'll see y'all tomorrow. Thanks for tuning in.